This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, looking ahead, will the next president be able to keep his campaign promise to increase foreign aid?
There's no question that people are hurting at home. There's no question that President Obama's administration will be focused like a laser beam on the domestic economy. That doesn't mean that great nations can't walk and chew gum at the same time.
Plus, drug violence ravages rural Mexico. And saying farewell to Mama Africa, we remember the life and music of Miriam Makeba.
That voice just really put me under its spell. You know, she just sounded so heavenly. I fell in love with that voice.
First, this hour's news. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The Mexican government is cracking down heavily on drug cartels and organized crime. There's been an explosion of violence as a result. Nearly 4,000 people have been killed this year alone. The violence touches some of the smallest towns and villages in the country. Altotonga is one of them. It's a pretty cobblestone town in the mountains of Veracruz. Conrad Fox visited the town, and he sent us this report.
Chris Bryles, a U.S. aid worker and missionary, has lived in Altotonga for about 8 years. As he stands in front of his house on the town's main street, he says in the last 2 years, there's been a dramatic increase in drug-related shootings here.
Well, we've got shootings that go on in the streets now that we never used to. We had one go on in front of our house. The man from the telephone company was working to restore our telephone, and he was on top of the pole, and we had a Old West-type shooting going down the main street. He came down the pole and said he'd come back the next day to finish the job because he was too shaken up by it.
A few weeks later, three men were gunned down in broad daylight, a few blocks from Bryles' house, reportedly over a drug-related dispute. Much of Mexico's drug violence is over who controls shipment routes to the U.S. Just a few miles out of town, Bryles carefully drives his pickup along a dirt road, clinging to the side of a mountain face. The slopes are thick with palms and cactus, intermixed with pine trees. Simple mud brick houses can be seen here and there, half hidden by the forest. Life here is hard, says Bryles.
The main staple of food here is the tortilla, and beans and rice are the principal foods. If they have any meat, they will usually take a chicken, kill it, and then they'll make that chicken last 2 or 3 days. And it may be a really warm day here, but they'll be eating soup because maybe all they got left over is the chicken bones.
This remote terrain has long been a hotbed of marijuana production. Bryles says he's frequently seen the plant growing among the corn or beans. We don't find any today, but we come across Leoncio Tapia repairing a fence on the edge of his field. He used to grow marijuana.
Unfortunately, I've had to do it because I'm poor. Most of us poor people, we do it out of necessity, even if we're just planting a little bit that'll give us a quarter kilo or a half a kilo.
For many farmers, marijuana offers a guaranteed income at a time when the price of traditional cash crops like coffee are declining. But the farmers rarely get rich, says sociologist Luis Astorga, an expert on the illegal drug industry.
For many, it's a question of survival, something they couldn't do growing legal crops, but that's just to survive. Everyone knows the ones who make the least profit are the growers themselves. If some of them are dreaming of someday having a nice pickup truck or whatever, it's very few of them who are going to make it.
Leoncio Tapia's family has paid a steep price for being in the drug business. Shootouts with neighbors over land to grow marijuana killed his father and brother. Tapia says that his neighbors stopped growing the drug after a police crackdown a few years ago. So why the violence in the region? Rumors abound of a new, more organized operation further up the mountains. It's too dangerous for me to go, but a contact elsewhere arranges for me to meet a farmer from one of the villages there.
Piedra, que le dicen piedra. Así abunda por ahí.
Now it's crack, he says. The farmer doesn't want his name used for fear of reprisals. We'll call him Don Eduardo. The gangs, he says, began growing marijuana 20 years ago, when coffee prices fell. Then, several switched to the more lucrative business of crack cocaine. Village life here used to be peaceful, he says.
All that changed because of the drugs. They started to kill. To kill.
por dinero y por la envidia.
For the money. For envy.
Por la envidia. Se van matando. Pero salen a matar.
They'll go a long way to kill someone.
Experts agree that the lure of profits, especially in poor regions like Alto Tonga, makes stamping out the drug trade difficult. Again, sociologist Luis Astorga.
Estos cultivos siguieron el efecto cucaracha.
Drug plantations have experienced the cockroach effect. When the government started eradication campaigns, they just expanded to other parts of the country.
But Astorga thinks that while poverty may first lead many farmers to grow drugs, eventually the business becomes a family tradition.
O sea, su niñez se desarrolló entre campos de amapola y marihuana, ¿no? Entonces, para
the kids grow up around marijuana and heroin, and they think it's natural, like kids who grew up with Nintendo or computers or whatever.
Don Eduardo admits that this seems to have happened to his family. He and his son used to grow pot. Now his son is one of the chief perpetrators of violence in his village.
Pues quiere tener dinero para agarrar todo como es malo.
All he wants is money. He's bad. He's bad, that man. Yep. The authorities are scared of him because he's got a gang. He's already killed one man.
Don Eduardo admits that even he's now scared of his son. With drug violence raging across the country, it's the kind of fear many Mexicans are all too familiar with these days. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Alto Tonga, Mexico.
Later on in this show, Conrad tells us how he got the information for this story. But now, our guide to global music, Tendai Maposa, remembers Miriam Makeba, who died last week at the age of 76.
I first started listening to Miriam Makeba, I think in the early 60s. I just heard her on the radio, and that voice just really put me under its spell. You know, she just sounded so heavenly.
When you say heavenly, what do you mean? How would you describe her voice? What differentiates her from other African singers?
Well, it just sounded so different in the sense that it just sounded perfect. I don't know how to put it into words, but it was just so smooth, and I fell in love with that voice.
It is hard to put into words, so why don't we listen to something that you loved when you were younger? What would you suggest?
One of my early memories of listening to Miriam, I think, is Iya Guduza. I love that song. Iya Guduza, ndoti sele yo jendlini. Iya Guduza, ndoti mfazu seslungwini. Iya Guduza, ndoti sele.
Do you remember how old you were when that was a favorite of yours?
I think I was not yet into my teens.
What did you like about it?
Well, it's just something that I could sing along. I mean, I couldn't understand most of the words, but, you know, I could sing along.
Yeah? Are you a good singer?
I would not be doing this if I was a good singer.
What is that song about?
She talks about this guy who wants money, but he doesn't work. I can catch a bit of it because it's Zulu, and we have that language in Zimbabwe as well. The Ndebele people, it's very similar to Zulu. So I catch bits and pieces of it, though I'm not a very fluent speaker.
Miriam Makeba was a real strong activist against apartheid really early on, before the anti-apartheid movement became very popular here in the United States. So she was singing and protesting and resisting apartheid in South Africa back in the 60s. How do you remember her in terms of her relationship with the anti-apartheid movement?
I got to know about her activism as I grew older. And, you know, they used to play her music on the radio and say she was based in the United States. And as I was growing up, this country, which is now Zimbabwe, was also under a form of apartheid. It was called Rhodesia then. So they could not really explain why she was based in the United States. I think, you know, they couldn't mention her activism on radio here because it was state-owned. So as I grew older, I got to know about what was going on with Miriam. That really impressed me more about her, that, you know, she was doing what she was doing. And she could not come back home because the South African apartheid government had revoked her citizenship. She tried to get her passport to come and bury her mother who had died, or to come for the funeral of her mother. And then she found out that she could not be issued with a passport. They wouldn't issue her with a passport. So she was in exile.
She certainly protested apartheid very bravely. She composed a song for the Kenyan independence movement, and she worked with the United Nations as a goodwill ambassador. I'm wondering how much all of this will be a part of her legacy. Will it be her music or her activism against apartheid and for the oppressed?
I guess it depends on who you ask. For some of us who know what she was doing besides singing, it'll be for both. I think for a lot of people, it might just be for the music, because she really, really influenced a lot of people. I spoke to Angelique Kidjo, a current musician, African musician from Benin, and she mentioned Miriam as a major influence as she was growing up, and she said she listened to Miriam as a kid. And the girls from Zep Mama, they're based in Belgium, they also say Miriam was a major, major influence. And you talk to a lot of people, a lot of African musicians, they mention her as an influence. And her activism, I'm sure it'll be remembered as well, as I said before, by people who knew what she was doing. But for a lot of people, she will always be Mama Africa, I mean, the first African superstar.
Let's close with another one of your favorite songs from Miriam Makeba.
Okay, my next selection, my next and final selection is the song called Mbube, which was written by a guy called Solomon Linda. He's a fellow South African. It is a song which became the Lion Sleeps Tonight.
All right, Tendai, thanks so much for sharing your memories of Miriam Makeba with us.
It was a pleasure, Peggy. It's said that she has left us, but she has left us so much to listen to and to remember her by.
Coming up, we head to Cuba. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Cuba is the only communist country in the Western Hemisphere. It's rare for Americans to get firsthand news from there, and the country remains a mystery to many of us. We sent reporter Amelia de Souza to Cuba to find out what life is like for ordinary Cubans. In the weeks ahead, you'll be hearing several stories from her. But first, we asked Amelia about her time there. She said the people were friendly, but if they got caught even chatting with a journalist, they could have been arrested. That created some problems for Amelia.
I was being followed by the police, that I was under scrutiny, that there was suspicion by the local authorities in one town where I was reporting that I could have been a spy. And so I got picked up by the police and was interrogated for a couple of hours because I was seen talking to people about agriculture. I was seen talking to people about public health. I was asking too many questions about employment in Cuba, and the police picked me up and interrogated me. It made me realize at that moment what sort of pressure that Cubans live under every day, that they are constantly aware that they are being watched. So every person that spoke to me was taking a big risk.
Did you have trouble sleeping at night after you do those interviews, wondering if these people were going to be arrested or harassed?
Absolutely. When I was interrogated by the police, who told me that they had enough evidence to put me in jail and then deport me, I was like a cartoon character because I gulped. I literally went, you know, because I was thinking of my own skin, and then I was thinking about all those tapes. And I was smart enough to tell the person, don't give me your real name. But, you know, you're in a small town, the local police pick up your tapes, they can figure out whose voice that is criticizing the government. And so I was very nervous that while they were interrogating me, that they had sent another police officer to the house to search my things. They didn't do that, and I was able to leave the country with the tapes, with my materials, but I had to hide them. And I'm just relieved that I didn't put anyone in danger.
Amelia was able to speak with a number of ordinary Cubans, despite the obstacles. They told her they're struggling to put food on the table. Citizens do get a ration book that entitles them to a certain amount of food every month. But for many, it isn't enough. Here's Amelia de Souza's report from Trinidad in the southern part of Cuba.
On Alameda Street, a group of men surround a 500-pound pig being led by a rope around her shoulders. A bare-chested man in pink plaid shorts wants to sneak the pig through his house and into the backyard. His neighbor, Roberto Alvarez, says that in Cuba, this could get him in a lot of trouble.
He kills the pigs and he sells the meat for a little money, because he can't live on what the government pays him for his job. It's complicated, because if the police catch him, they will confiscate everything, the scale, the butcher knives, everything. They can even put him in prison.
Yes, prison. That's because nearly every form of private economic transactions are forbidden here, even buying and selling food. There are plainclothes policemen on every corner, and people have a tendency to live looking over their shoulder. Alvarez, which is not his real name, is one of only a handful of people willing to talk to a reporter. He says that finding enough food is particularly hard now because of the recent spate of hurricanes that destroyed many crops on the island. Back on Alameda Street, four burly men push the pig from behind through the doorway, while the fat, bare-chested man pulls on the rope. The pig digs her hooves into the floor and begins screaming. People gather and watch through the windows. Killing this pig is not exactly going to be a secret from the neighbors.
Nobody would ever say anything. They all benefit from it. The guy is going to give them a small piece of meat. Not a lot, but enough for them to keep quiet.
Getting this pig inside is hard work, but the payoff is pretty big. The owner, the guy in the pink shorts, will make about 1,000 pesos from the sale of the meat. That's the equivalent of $60, about four times the average monthly salary in Cuba. Alvarez says that selling food on the black market has become a way of life.
People sell fish, fruit, they sell chicken on a side street. It's all the same. They're doing it for a little money. Because if you don't, you can't get by. Almost every Cuban is doing it.
At the market in town, a lone man is chopping up some pork. The stalls are empty. There is not a mango, an onion, or a clove of garlic to be seen. Alvarez walks over to an empty stall.
This is where the pumpkins used to be. There we had onions, cucumbers, oranges, all sorts of things. Now there's nothing.
Alvarez says that people here have also been compensating by growing small home gardens in the backyard. But even this is illegal. His own father has a large plot of land where he grows bananas, mangoes, and corn. But he was too afraid to give an interview. He says if he is found out, the police will confiscate his produce and destroy his garden. But not everyone says life is so bad. Juanita Torres, also not her real name, is in her kitchen cleaning up the breakfast dishes. She makes a little money legally by renting a room in her house to visiting tourists, one of the only legal private businesses allowed in Cuba. More than 80% of her earnings go to the government. Torres says the ration book is a good thing. It ensures that everybody gets the same amount of food and nobody goes hungry. She worries that if people could buy and sell food at will, some would stockpile, while others would go without.
Porque hay personas que un ejemplo quieren acaparar.
You can't let people just buy as much food as they want. In these hard times, everybody gets half a bag of rice. It's not fair to buy three bags, especially since if next week the government will deliver more. Cubans believe in solidarity. They don't like to take things for just themselves.
But don't tell that to Roberto Alvarez. He has spent much of the afternoon at a hidden cove, where he and his friends caught a 6-foot-long catfish shark. They had originally agreed to let me record their expedition, then changed their minds at the last minute. But I watched as the men hastily cut the shark in pieces on the beach, split it up, and hid it in their bags. It was much like watching a drug deal, except it was food. Alvarez says butchering stolen horses in the forest is perhaps the area's most lucrative illicit food trade. But the penalty is severe, up to 30 years in prison.
If you go out and ask anybody which will get you more time in jail in Cuba, killing a person or killing a horse, everybody will tell you the same thing. Killing a horse is worse.
He is not joking. In most cases, killing a horse gets you more time in jail than killing a person. Just one example of how the state uses an iron hand to restrict private commerce. So while the government goes to great lengths to keep all Cubans economically equal, Cubans struggle equally hard and in secret to find more food and a better living, despite some pretty dire consequences. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amelia De Souza in Trinidad, Cuba.
If you want to hear more about Amelia's experiences in Cuba, you can read her blog. It's on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Long before Cuba became communist, it was famous for its music. From mambo to cha-cha to salsa, the beat of Cuban music brought people onto dance floors around the world. And this is what people are dancing to, or listening to, right now.
Con amor, otra vez. Quiero cantarle hoy esta tierra santa, lindo caimán que ya se levanta, al son de caña, tabaco y ron.
Straight from the Havana Hit Parade, that was La Habana Me Llama. It's the newest music and dance craze to come out of Cuba. Called Timba, it's a mix of traditional music and mambo. And the group performing it is Manolito Simone y su Trabuco. It tours Europe regularly, and it's been spotted a few times in Miami and New York City. President-elect Obama has made many public statements about his commitment to international aid. He says he wants to increase the foreign aid budget from $25 billion to $50 billion by 2012. That would build on the substantial increase in foreign aid made by President Bush. And like President Bush, the next administration will have to deal with Darfur, AIDS orphans, and famines, not to mention rising food prices around the world. We've invited Tom Hart onto the show to discuss the president-elect's commitments. He's director of government relations at the nonprofit organization called ONE. It works to raise public awareness about global poverty, hunger, and disease.
President-elect Obama, on the campaign trail, made some really bold commitments to fighting poverty and disease around the world. Starting with and sort of underlying all of that is a commitment to the Millennium Development Goals, a set of goals that were agreed to by the international community in the year 2000 to cut global poverty in half, as well as achieve universal basic education, halting the spread of AIDS, and other development priorities. And President-elect Obama has said that he wants to take these goals and make them U.S. policy.
So the budget would go from $25 billion a year in foreign aid to $50 billion. That might sound like a lot, but it's only what percent of our budget, our national budget?
The current spending on foreign assistance is less than 1% of the entire federal budget. So doubling it would, well, the federal budget will, of course, grow, but it will be, you know, a bit more than 1%, a little under 2% if his objectives are achieved.
Let's say he pursues this agenda of increasing foreign aid. What has he outlined as his top three priorities when it comes to foreign aid?
I would say global health has been a key one, and in that I would include a robust support for fighting HIV/AIDS in the poorest countries, particularly Africa, and an exciting proposal on malaria to end deaths from malaria within his term. So I think that's a really challenging and very doable, bold initiative that he has put out there. He also has committed to supporting agricultural development, clean water, which of course is foundational to health and education in the poorest countries, as well as supporting getting kids in school. So that's just a brief overview of some of the things that he's committed to.
Now, Tom, these plans that Obama has put forth in terms of how he wants to help the developing world certainly sound good, and they did when he made these commitments back in November of 2007. Our economic situation is different today than it was a year ago, and both President-elect Obama and Biden have made comments recently saying that they may not really be able to deliver on this.
In a number of media interviews, Senator Obama was asked what he would cut back of his campaign promises given the economic crisis. He said he mentioned his pledge to double foreign assistance, and he said, quote, "We may have to delay that a little bit." Obviously, we hoped at the time that he was not meaning that he would cut foreign aid, and indeed he clarified very specifically that that did not mean that he would not reach a doubling of foreign assistance. It might take a little longer than just the 4 years to achieve it.
And I'm wondering, how supportive do you think Americans really are going to be about something like increasing funding for AIDS when they can't maybe find a job?
There's no question that people are hurting at home. There's no question that President Obama's administration will be focused like a laser beam on the domestic economy and how that is impacted by the global economy. That is going to be priority number one, as the new chief of staff has said. That doesn't mean that great nations can't walk and chew gum at the same time. It also doesn't mean that that given the financial crisis, that this isn't one of the most cost-effective investments we can make in terms of our foreign policy. One of the big priorities and hopes that I think the American public have expressed is that the United States regain a bit of its stature globally. Well, there's no question that our development assistance, our ability to save lives in the most remote and sometimes fragile parts of the world, has a tremendous impact on how the world sees America.
Tom, I want to take a look now at President Bush and his legacy in this area. He goes out of office with pretty low poll numbers. But one thing many have applauded President Bush for is his strong leadership when it has come to international aid, particularly in combating AIDS. How would you define the legacy President Bush leaves the incoming president?
In this arena, I think President Bush deserves enormous credit. Clearly, PEPFAR, the president's AIDS program, was an historic announcement. It was historic both in terms of its size. It was the largest and proposed largest investment in global health of any single disease. And it also turned the politics upside down. It certainly had a Nixon going to China quality to it, a conservative Republican administration proposing a bold increase in foreign aid in the poorest parts of the world with a highly stigmatized disease. He's got quite a strong record on many, many other elements, including fighting malaria. His own malaria initiative, called the President's Malaria Initiative, has begun great work in distributing bed nets and providing treatment to people. He has continued and expanded a program from President Clinton on Africa trade called the African Growth and Opportunity Act. He initiated with the British government 100% multilateral debt cancellation, so the poorest countries wouldn't have to pay back more to the World Bank and IMF than they were spending in health or education. So this administration and this president, I think, has really taken a leadership role in Africa and set a really strong foundation upon which the Obama administration can build.
All right, Tom Hart, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great, thanks for having me.
Tom Hart is Director of Government Relations at the organization One. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. It's time for the latest in our street vendor series. Kira Neal tells us recycling takes on a whole new meaning in the West African country of Mali.
The marketplace in the town of Mopti is filled with haggling vendors, stray dogs, motorcycles, and children. But as I walked through this cacophony, I was drawn to a back alleyway by another sound. That's when I came upon a street lined with the stalls of more than 20 metal workers. 23-year-old Benge Sinogo was one of them. Like all the men here, he makes a living pounding metal drums into frying pans. He works sitting on a low stool surrounded by hammers of various sizes. Unlike a blacksmith, metal workers use no heat to reshape metal. My brother taught me how to do this work, he says. I've been working as a metal worker for 6 years. First, Benge places a flattened piece of metal on the inner circumference of a truck tire. Then he hits the metal with a small hammer, and rotating the piece quickly, he rounds the metal into the shape of a frying pan. Next, using his toes for leverage, Benge deftly folds another piece of metal into a handle shape with a few quick hits of a large blunt hammer. He attaches the two pieces with a small sharp nail. I can make 2 frying pans an hour, he says. The frying pans are made from recycled oil drums. There's a stockpile of these rusting containers across the road from where he works. They were once filled with peanut oil, he says. Then they were filled and refilled with diesel oil until the barrels could no longer be used. Once I sell everything I can make with that barrel, he says, I can make a profit of 2,000 seifa. That's about $4. Benge, like all the metal workers here, recycles all kinds of metals, including car frames and empty food containers. The walls of his stall glint in the sun with coffee cans turned into toy airplanes and cooking oil tins that are now watering cans. And of course, there are the gleaming oil drum frying pans that can be found in kitchens and marketplaces all over the country. For the World Vision Report, I'm Kira Neal in Mopti, Mali.
Coming up, what exactly is Burners Without Borders? We'll tell you after a short break. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. You've probably heard of Doctors Without Borders. Now we'd like to introduce you to Burners Without Borders. Burners is the name given to the 50,000 people who attend the Burning Man Arts Festival every summer. They camp out in the remote Nevada desert. They create art and party into the night. But that's not all they do. Eric Whitney has more.
In August of 2007, an earthquake hit the city of Pisco on the coast of Peru. It leveled 80% of Pisco's homes. Nadia Rodegrados was on her way to pick up her daughter at school when the trembler hit. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening.
I thought it was the end of the world. The sky cleared and the earth wouldn't stop shaking.
Her family was unhurt, but their house, like those of everyone around them, was destroyed.
The neighbors and us just got some mattresses and blankets and whatever we could find, and we slept next to a wall that we didn't think would collapse.
The same day, 5,000 miles to the north in California, a 29-year-old construction worker named Sam Block was on his way to the Burning Man Festival. A phone call stopped him cold. It was from a friend he'd met as a tsunami relief volunteer in Thailand a couple of years earlier.
He's like, well, about 4 hours ago, there was an 8.0 earthquake in Pisco, Peru, and I've already quit my job and already bought a plane ticket. When are you coming down and joining?
Block and his friend hadn't been part of any formal relief team in Thailand. They just went and offered their skills to whoever needed them. Block agreed to meet his friend in Peru.
Instead of coming down on my own, you know, like I did in Thailand, just packing up my own tools and coming down on my own, I decided to, you know, try to do something more.
Block still decided to go to Burning Man before heading to Peru. But unlike the other revelers, Block wasn't there for the all-night parties, the body painting, or to make one of the crazy sculptures that are often set on fire when they're done. He went to ask the festival's organizers for help. He knew that 2 years earlier, a group of burners had traveled to Mississippi on a relief mission after Hurricane Katrina. Block wanted to do the same thing for the earthquake victims. He got the okay and launched the first international mission of what's now called Burners Without Borders.
the people and the resources you have through Burning Man make you ideal for a disaster zone. We live out in the desert where there's no water, no electricity, and, you know, really, really high winds and dust storms and a lot of similar things to Pisco, you know. And as well as you have a lot of think-outside-the-box people, resourceful people that find alternate ways of doing things.
Block packed some construction tools, gathered his long dreadlocks into a ponytail, and arrived in Pisco with $300 and a tent to sleep in. He quickly partnered with a group that specializes in disaster response. When it left, Block took over its headquarters, staying for a year. That meant exhausting his personal savings and getting a loan from Mom. But Block had lots of company. Putting out the word through the Burner's informal but well-established network, he was soon joined by dozens of volunteers from around the world. They started rebuilding houses and schools, like this one in a poor neighborhood. The Burners gave their labor to anyone who needed their help, from the UN and the Peruvian government to local people who just walked up to them and asked. Connor Cusack, from Ireland, had never heard of Burning Man, but volunteered when he saw a Burners flyer in a youth hostel. Overseeing this construction crew, he says it's hard to describe a typical Burner.
That's a difficult one. Very friendly, very open, and fun-loving. I think is one way of putting it. Yeah, they like to have a good time, but they really like to get things done and to help people as well.
25-year-old Kristen Labrador is a teacher from Denver who's on Cusack's building crew. She's a regular at the Burning Man Festival, which she describes as a brief week of utopia in a world filled with conflict. She says she goes to feel like a kid again. But here in Peru, things are more serious.
We are pouring the foundation of a school. It's a 3-room classroom, and I helped to build the brick walls.
Pretty hard work.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Everything is by hand.
And this is your vacation?
This is my vacation. And I love it.
These students are some of the 250 who now have classrooms thanks to the Burners. They built 3 schools, more than 100 houses, and cleared countless tons of rubble. And since the Pisco project was launched, other Burners groups have popped up to respond to other big disasters, including the hurricanes on the American Gulf Coast. Burners are also getting together for smaller local projects, volunteering to help out wherever they live. It's the same spirit that drives people to create ever more elaborate art projects, costumes, and games for the annual Burning Man Festival. For the World Vision Report, I'm Eric Whitney in Pisco, Peru.
Eric Whitney and all reporters often have to rely on sources they don't know much about. Take our correspondent, Conrad Fox. He recently traveled in Mexico to report on drugs and violence, a story you heard about earlier in the show. And Conrad got lots of information from a farmer who used to grow marijuana. The farmer had once been involved in drug violence himself. But Conrad didn't know that when he started talking to him. Instead, what he heard was the normal concerns of fathers everywhere. Here's Conrad's reporter's notebook.
I sit with Leoncio in his shack and make small talk, waiting for an opportunity to ask him about the drug business. From time to time, his wife appears from a smoky kitchen to drop fresh tortillas in front of me. 2 little barefoot girls cling shyly to Leoncio's legs, while behind us, his teenage son sits staring into the distance. Agustin won't talk, says Leoncio. He's deaf. After lunch, father and son head out to cut hay for their animals. Leoncio communicates to Agustin with signals. Go get the machete. Go get the sharpening stone. Meanwhile, I need to do some research for my story, so I go out for a walk in the hills, hoping to stumble across a marijuana crop. When I come back several hours later, sweating and dirty, I find Agustin grooming a small donkey in a field. His younger sisters look on quietly. The animal, they explain, was a present from their dad to their brother when the boy turned 17. Out here, that's like getting a car for graduation. Later that night, after a dinner of beans and tortillas, I try to ease the conversation to the subject of drugs. But Leoncio's got other things on his mind. I don't know what he's going to do when I'm gone, says Leoncio, pointing to Agustin and frowning with concern. Out here, there's no speech therapists, no sign language classes. He used to go to school, says Leoncio. He was top of the class and did all his homework. Then one day, the kids were lined up for their school lunch. But when Agustin went up to get his, the teacher said, no. none for you. The teacher, said Leoncio, had figured Agustin no longer belonged in the school. After that, he showed us by signs that no, he would never go back to school. By the time Leoncio finishes the story, he's shaking with rage. Later, when the two of us are alone, Leoncio finally talks about his past. He does so quietly, unbidden, almost like a man confessing. It's a long, convoluted story of disputes over drug crops, informant neighbors, and blood feuds. It begins with him accused of murder. He insists he never did it, but his protests sound half-hearted. The next day, I stand on the road with Leoncio and flag down a ride on a truck. When I get in the cab, the driver asks, "You know that guy?" Meaning Leoncio. He makes a gun with his thumb and forefinger. "That guy's a killer." But in the end, what stuck with me wasn't his violent past or his links to the world of narco-traffickers. It was his hospitality, his confiding in me, the concern for his son that any father could understand. Despite his reputation, I went back weeks later and showed the family photos I'd taken of them. They gather round and laugh like they were normal, everyday people, and not the family of someone who may well have been a killer.
That was our Mexico correspondent, Conrad Fox. Conrad might want to do a little shopping in Mexico City, and we're not talking designer clothes. Here's our globe at a glance. There's a tiny boutique in Mexico City that's making a lot of money right now. It's the Caballero Boutique. It specializes in high security fashion. In plain English, that means bulletproof clothing. The shop stocks everything from frilly dress shirts to leather jackets, to full-length coats. And they all have bulletproof panels in case of a sudden shootout. There's another way this store is a bit different from other clothing stores. The clothes are stacked, not according to size, but based on how well they'll protect you from a bullet. Good, better, best. And to make sure that the clothes actually do offer protection, the store makes each staff member take a turn at being shot at. Sales are on the rise, according to the store manager. It's not hard to understand why, when murder and kidnapping fill the nightly news. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Waymire. Actress Scarlett Johansson loves them. So does Spider-Man's Tobey Maguire. Even former President Bill Clinton is a fan. I'm talking about Tom's Shoes. Tom isn't a person, it's a brand name, and it's been taking the fashion scene by storm. It's the brainchild of Blake Makowski. You may know his name from TV's The Amazing Race. He and his sister competed in the worldwide contest a few years ago. They didn't win, but they did see a lot of the world. It was during that time that Blake went to Argentina. He saw something there that stopped him in his tracks.
I saw, you know, hundreds and hundreds of kids not wearing shoes. And it hit me really hard because it was the first time that I had experienced that level of poverty. And immediately I wanted to do something about it. So my first thought was, I'm going to go tomorrow and I'm going to buy 250 pairs of shoes and I'm going to bring them back and I'm going to be like Santa Claus. And I told one of the girls about this idea. And immediately she said, well, that's really a bad idea. And I said, why is that a bad idea? I mean, I'm going to give them shoes. They don't have shoes. She goes, well, you'll feel really great about it. But then when you leave and 4 or 5 months go down the road and they outgrow them or they wear out, who's going to give them shoes then? So unless you plan on giving them shoes over and over again, you're better just not doing it at all. And that, to me, that was a very, you know, interesting point and one that I couldn't argue with. So I want to come up with a sustainable way to give the children shoes. And that's why I started Tom's Shoes with a very simple premise. We would sell shoes, and for every pair of shoes we sold, we would give one away.
This is a pretty big endeavor to take on. You just see kids barefoot and decide to start a whole new company?
Well, I think that, you know, I've been an entrepreneur since I was 18. I've started 4 different companies. That's just kind of the way that I think. And I wanted to do something, and it wasn't just like, oh, I'll start a business, but that was kind of a process of elimination. The idea of starting a charity was very daunting to me because then I'd have to ask people for money every year, and I'd never done that before. But what I had done before was start a business. So to me, that was it might sound crazy to some people, but it was a very natural, you know, kind of process of elimination of, oh, just start a business, sell a shoe, give away a shoe.
How can you do that? Is that profitable to sell one and give one away?
We're not, Tom Shoes isn't profitable yet, but we're built to be a for-profit business. So, you know, we hope that with volume it grows, the small margin that we have in profit will eventually allow us to not only pay our employees, sell shoes and give a shoe away, but also be a profitable business. Because being profitable is what gives us really long-term sustainability.
So you've been doing this now for 2 years. What do the shoes look like?
Now, we took an Argentine design, a shoe called the Alpargata that had been in Argentina for hundreds of years, had a rope sole, canvas upper, and we made it more comfortable. We put a rubber sole on the bottom, we put an arch support in it, and we made them with the idea that, you know, we'd sell them in all different colors, shapes, and sizes, and that's where we started.
Okay, now I've got to say, we've actually done some stories about people who put shoes on kids and sell shoes, but no one sells as much as you do. How in the world have you sold so many shoes so fast? What is it about your shoes or your marketing or whatever that has made this such a popular thing?
Well, I think that we were, like, first off, I think we were the first company to kind of say, we're going to sell a pair of shoes, and for every pair we sell, we're going to give one away. It wasn't a percentage. It wasn't a formula. It was completely transparent and very easy to understand. I think that's one of the things that has caused, you know, Tom's message to grow so fast. You can explain it. So when you're wearing the pair of shoes and someone says, oh, those look different, I've never seen those shoes before, then you don't say, oh, they're Tom's and that's it. You tell the whole story. And then when you tell the whole story to that person, there's a very good chance that they're going to go online and buy a pair. So every person that buys a pair of Toms then almost becomes the brand ambassador of Toms, and that it has an incredible multiplier effect. And the way I can explain the multiplier effect is in our first 6 months, we sold and gave away 10,000 pairs of shoes, which was incredible, and I never thought we would do that many. But the next year, we sold and gave away 50,000 pairs of shoes, and this year, we'll sell and give away 300,000 pairs of shoes. The other very big component of it is, and I think it's a little bit of a luck that Tom's had when we first started, is the fashion community really took to Tom's shoes. So about 4 months after I started, I got a call from Vogue magazine. And then from that, you know, we've been featured in GQ, Elle, Harper's Bazaar, you know, pretty much every major fashion magazine.
Why? Because of the idea, or because you were on the Amazing Race, or why?
I think that two things. I think the idea was an interesting story, but also I think that this shoe is very in fashion right now. You're seeing a lot of, you know, flats have been more popular for the last few years. So I think we hit it just right in terms of timing with the trends of fashion. But then also I think fashion, just like every business, is looking for a way to incorporate giving into their story. And most fashion people aren't that philanthropic in terms of their business models. So the fashion industry kind of adopted me and used me as kind of their centerpiece of, look, the fashion community does good too. So I started getting invited to all the, you know, big designer dinners with, you know, Marc Jacobs and everyone from, you know, Diane von Furstenberg to Karl Lagerfeld. And I didn't know who any of these people were at that point. Now I know, you know, obviously quite well. But I think that, and I think the shoe's very comfortable and it's very affordable.
The first 6 months you sold 10,000 shoes, and I'm assuming then you went and you call it a drop-off. You dropped off 10,000 shoes in Argentina. Tell me about these drop-offs. How does that work?
Well, I mean, it's total chaos. I wish it wasn't, but it is. I mean, you have, you know, several hundred kids getting a pair of shoes sometimes for the first time or a new pair of shoes, and they're extremely excited. It wasn't until I actually did the first shoe drop where we gave 10,000 pairs of shoes where I was like, I don't want to do anything else but this. And because it was so incredible to see not only the smiles on the kids' faces, but the experience of actually giving with other people who I really cared about. So my parents were there, my brother and sister were there. I took all of our interns with me to Argentina. We had 16 people, and we spent, you know, 2 weeks putting 10,000 shoes directly on the feet of these kids. And I, you know, we haven't slowed down since then.
Okay. Blake Makowski, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tom's Shoes now delivers all around the world. This year, they're beginning a new program that'll allow ordinary people like you or me to go with them to help with the deliveries. You can find out more on our website, worldvisionreport.org. There's lots to do there. You can download a podcast and read blogs from our reporters around the world. And there's a place for listener comments. And we invite you to tell us what you think, good or bad, about the show. We leave you today with music from Miriam Makeba, Mama Africa, who died last week at age 76. program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignments editor. Our producers are Christina Darden and Cynthia Graber. Our audio engineers are Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.